Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Joining me today is my girlfriend, Juliana. Say hello.
Hello.
And what are we going to do today, Juliana?
We're going to review the State of the Art
Yes,
book.
We're continuing on with our culture series reading book club read-along, and in case you haven't been listening along, we're not doing the books in publication order, we're doing the books in a different order, the order that I think fits really well, because all these books could be just written, they could be read in any order, yeah. But it kind of makes sense to do them in a specific order, and someone said, actually, when we were talking about, you know, once Ian and Banks died, we were chatting on the Goodreads SFBRP listener group, and someone said, "Ah, if you want to read the culture, start off with The State of the Art." And I'm like, don't start off with State of the Art. And instead of that, they said, "Well, what order would you read them?" So I said, "Ah, I would go Player of Games, Consider Phlebas, Accession, Use of Weapons, then State of the Art, Inversions, Matter, Surface Detail, The Hydrogen Sonata, and Look to Windward." Those are the 10 main stories, like 9 novels, a novella, and some short stories which you can read along with State of the Art. And one of the reasons why I have this order, and that you should definitely not start off with State of the Art, is that it's good to read the book or read through the series, you could read the series and you think, all of the culture and all of the humans in the culture, these are humans, and this is set in the far future of Earth. Yes. And it's only actually when you get to State of the Art, in our reading list, if you read, it actually mentions it in Use of Weapons, because it's the same character. Dizier Smart is one of the main characters in Use of Weapons, and here in this book, and these two actually in this order are swapped around. In our order, is swapped around from the chronological order in these two books. Actually, because Dizier Smart does this, has an adventure in State of the Art, and then goes on to Use of Weapons. But I think it works just as well the other way around. But it takes until book four or five, in either publication order or this reading order, to understand that, hey, wait a second, this is not our future. The Earth exists, and the culture is different. The culture is separate. We are not the culture, and the culture is not us. There were fundamental differences between our history and the history of the culture.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important to understand the culture.
So while I was reading this State of the Art, I was really a lot thinking about what is the culture? Where does it come from? Where are the roots of it?
Yeah.
And because I think it says somewhere the culture are human similar people or something.
Yeah, human standard people or something.
I mean, Dizziet Smart, she obviously has a nose and ears and fingers and toes.
Yes, but she's got not enough joints in her fingers to pass
exactly.
on Earth.
But she obviously looks close enough to a human being.
Well, it's more humanoid.
But where do they come from?
Well, funny you should say that, but that's actually explained a little bit more as you go on through the series. Once you get to Hydrogen Sonata, even though it was the last book that was written, there's actually more about the founding of the culture in the Hydrogen Sonata, which was the last culture book written, than there is in the earliest ones.
Okay.
You know, because the first books are all like, you know, Consider Phlebas and Accession, and they're very much dealing with like a big war, you know, the Edirian culture war, and that is like where the story of the culture begins. It's once it became a big enough player on the galactic stage, what they say, the in play, it became an in play civilization in the galaxy, and that's kind of where its story as the culture begins.
Okay.
As the culture as we know it.
Yes.
You know, before then they weren't, you know, they didn't have the power that they had and the influence that they had and the control that they had, that they were completely controlling their own destiny. There was other influences going on there.
Yes, right. And because reading this book, I mean, there are doubts, I would call them, coming up reading this book.
About the culture?
About the culture by this guy, Linter. And I was thinking, and yes, actually, that is true. I mean, there is the ship. But the ship was built by other machines. But who built those machines?
Yeah, and it goes back and back.
It's like the the chicken and the egg question.
Yeah, well, in the past, some non-machine intelligence would have built the first machine.
Exactly.
The
mind machine. Yes.
But to be clear, to bring up some stuff which is actually, you know, which has also comes up in Hydrogen Sonata and in this and in these other books, it's kind of understood that. Well, let me approach this from a different. I didn't know you were going to ask this question, but this is a good question actually. The way that I look at the culture, it is not Earth, so we can tie it back at that. We are the Earth is not the culture. The culture
yes.
doesn't come from the Earth.
No.
But then I was listening to the Geek Nights podcast and Rim and Scott, you know, these guys in New York. You've not met them, have you? No, but
no.
But those guys they read Play of Games for their book club on their podcast, and they were really into it. And then Rim has gone and read like all of the other culture books, and they're just saying, "Oh, it's amazing! You know, this is great,
yeah.
this is great." But the way that he talks about it, it's like this is the culture I want to live in, and I'm like, "Yeah, I would like to live in the culture,
me
in
too,
the culture
me too.
Too." But the only way for Earth to become part of the culture is to be contacted by the culture and invited
yeah.
in.
Like
there
is
no way for us to get from Earth now to the culture.
Yes,
you know, and that's the thing with all. All utopian thinking by communists, by you know, libertarians, by you know, all these people who have like this utopian view of the world. There's never a way to get from our world now to or our civilization now, even just within a country. There's no way to get from a country from one way, one kind of way of working, which has evolved over, you know, thousands of years of history to
yes.
one specific point, to then like skip over in one generation and suddenly it's like, and now we're communist, and it's like, great. And but to
or
get
now,
there,
now it, there's no money anymore.
Yeah. Oh no, now there's no money. But unfortunately, the way that humanity seems to play this out is, if you want to suddenly change all the rules and become a utopian society, you've kind of just got to kill off or deport all of the people who disagree with you. You know,
yeah.
that's the only way to get to
yeah.
like to get to the Soviet communist utopia that they're going. It's like, well, we're going to have to kill off probably about 20 million. Of our own citizens and deport the rest, you know, and
yeah,
you know,
right.
leave behind the people. And I'm not saying that that would have to happen for us to become for Earth to become culture-like. I'm just saying that utopian thinking does. We can't get from us to utopia. So what my point is about this, I'm not saying that Ian M. Banks agrees with this, but one of the main reasons I think, or the way that I read it, one of the main reasons that he keeps the beginning of the culture kind of wishy-washy and fuzzy is to stop us going, ah, well, how can we get on track to the culture?
Yeah, right.
Like,
he's
what
giving,
is the way from
not
here
giving
today?
A recipe for
yeah.
humanity. Hey, this is how you can become a hedonistic, cool society.
Yeah, with no rules
with
and no laws.
And,
yeah, yeah.
And everything is fine. And like drones and robots and mines taking care of you.
Yeah.
That doesn't work. Like
no,
that.
But that's what I'm saying. That for nobody to have to work anymore and for robots to take over, we're probably going to have a robot apocalypse first and
yeah.
then, you know, to beat down the robots and, you know, all of those things that we say, oh, we'd have to be contacted by aliens first. You know, there's
yeah.
so many different steps to get there that I quite like that this isn't, oh, in the year 2023, humanity makes a computer that's self-aware. In the year 2028, the computer
yeah, right.
takes over the world and,
yeah.
and becomes a benign ruler and creates a mind and then creates another mind. You know, there isn't any of that. It's just like, these are the rules that have been set up for this utopian society. And here's an attack from outside to that utopian society. And here's that utopian society going across here. I say utopian, but what I'm saying is like, this. You can view the culture as a utopia.
Yeah.
Not all of the characters in the book do, and I don't see the culture as a utopian society for anybody outside of it, which is a weird thing that I'm sure I'll get into on some later books as well. You know, it's like
yeah.
if you're in the culture, it's a utopia, but if you haven't joined the culture yet,
yeah.
it's not a utopia.
If you haven't joined it yet,
yeah.
and the culture hasn't decided yet what to do with you.
Yes, it's like it's an interesting system. It's a very nice system for life forms within it. And who agree with it and want to go along with it, and who are lucky enough to be born into it, who don't know anything else, you know. So yes, that's one of the reasons why I don't think State of the Art should be read first, because it kind of lays all those cards out on the table too early to say the culture is not Earth, and you're like, oh, that's why
yes.
it does. That's why those lines haven't been
also,
connected
it,
together.
It gives a weird view on the culture. Having all these, like, this little these little problems with the guy wanting to stay on Earth and stuff.
Well, let's talk about that. So yeah. We'll talk about the state of the art, which is the novella, and then we'll talk about some of the other two short stories, which are based in the culture within the state of the art collection. So yeah, it's Earth has been contacted, or no, it hasn't been contacted, but a contact ship has turned up, and
sent down.
What was the name of the ship? It was the
Arbitrary.
The Arbitrary, yeah. So the actually, I have the Wikipedia page open right here, so I can look here. It doesn't actually say very much about it. Anyway, so there's the ship called the Arbitrary. Oh yeah, there's a list here, and then there's Dizzy Osmar, who is, we know her from the State of the Art, or we get to know her here and then move on to the the State of the Art, the Use of Weapons. She's also in that, and there's one other main character in terms of plot of the book, and that is Lintner, Dervli Lintner, he goes down and stays in Paris and becomes kind of socialized. And it actually says in the book, which I really like, it's like, hey, this is the plot of every different serial or every different movie, is the plot of contact person goes down, falls in love with the local and decides to stay. Yes. Yeah. But the local that he falls in love with is Paris and the Earth itself.
Yes.
And he decides that he wants to stay. And then Dizzy Osmar is like, I think you should come back. And the ship is like, I don't think you should stay. And it's about the conflict between the ship and Dizzy Osmar and Lintner. Kind of, there's this always like this, they're always playing off against each other, aren't they? There's like, one person wants one thing, one person wants the other thing, the other one wants something in the middle, but the one in the middle plays the other two off each other while the, you know,
and
they're
the
all...
ship, the ship kind of is using Dizzy Osmar to get in contact with Lintner. To talk to him, and she doesn't even know what she's talking about, and then she figures out, the ship wants me to convince Lintner.
But I also get the feeling that the ship is sends Dizier to him to begin with, not just to convince Lintner in one way or the other, but also to kind of have him convince her that the Earth should be left alone, because she's like, we should get in there and we should intervene, because there's all these genocides and nuclear weapons pointed at each other, and the culture needs to intervene to sort out all the Earth's problem.
Right.
And I, one thing I found interesting, because like I read this book before, and then since listening to it, since reading the book, I then listened to it as the BBC audiobook kind of like play, audio play, audio drama adaptation. And then when I read the book again this time through, I listened to that like maybe six, seven years ago, this time I was listening through, I kind of had the BBC adaptation in my head, but one of the main questions that I thought was resolved at the end was, when the culture find Earth, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to intervene, or are they going to leave it? And it turns out, like, in the very first chapter of this novella, or, like, in the first few pages, it's like, and we've decided that we're not going to intervene, we're going to leave it and study it. It's going to be our, like, it's going to be a control in our galaxy-wide, because everything's so perfect there. They're in the right point of the technology that they're going to do this, and we have to sometimes not bring in a planet, even if they're good, to bring it in, just to see what happens to them. Anyway, like, yes. I quite like that they're the control in the experiment, in the galactic experiment of contact or not contact.
Yeah.
So what would happen if planets were just left by themselves and Earth is going to be one of them? Which is actually, I think, quite a genius way
saying... It's like to have a wood kept by itself, not being... looked
yeah,
after.
Yeah, like a bit of forest. Yeah,
just have, like, the trees fall down and, like animals do what they want, and to see how...
How the wood would look after itself
by
itself.
This is what we do, and the culture is in that book actually exactly doing the same.
Yeah, but I thought that was one of the main things that would be solved at the end of the book, but it turns out like they kind of just decide it right at the very beginning. It's like, and that's what we're going to do, and then and now we're going to stay here and study it for the next year.
When I was reading that, I had quite a good idea while reading it. There was this one point where this Lee, he had this... This speech where he did.
Oh yeah.
And then I thought, because he wanted the Earth to be destroyed.
Well, that's what he was saying.
Exactly. So I had the idea, because like thinking of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all this, and in other books, in Accession, the the ship being able to move whole things.
Yeah,
to
whole planets. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So I had actually the idea what the culture would do.
Yeah.
Because I haven't finished reading it at that point. I thought they would just transport all the humans onto a fake Earth.
Yeah.
To get the actual planet a bit of rest from the humans. Earth could just come back and just get better.
Like old nature, give nature a rest.
Give nature a rest from human beings.
Yeah.
And
but why would the culture care about the nature of Earth? They've got so many other planets which have got so much other life on them.
Yeah, but
it's like us worrying about what's happening in one flower bed in one park in Berlin.
Yeah, exactly. And some humans actually would care and then remove it and would do. And some of the ships are quite excessive, as we know from Accessions. And they have these hobbies, and one of the hobby could be just let's just get all the humans and
but then the humans would then definitely be contacted, wouldn't they?
No, they wouldn't even recognize. They wouldn't realize that. Like just on another planet, or
like
just
that's exactly
planet.
Like Earth.
No, yeah, or inside the ship.
But why? No, but that doesn't make sense because they wouldn't be on it. They wouldn't be on Earth.
No, they wouldn't because the humans wouldn't be that clever.
No, they would because it was 1970s. It was set in like 1976 or something.
Yes,
you know.
But we know that ships are so huge that they actually can.
No, they can't. They can't take whole entire planets on board.
Yeah,
with them.
But yeah,
they could take billions of people, but there's not enough land. There's not the same amount. Every human on Earth has got like.
Yeah, but they. Anyway, okay. That was my idea, and I thought it was quite a clever idea. Also inspired by Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where they are.
Funny you should say that, because we were listening to this audio drama from the BBC just before we did this, like.
Yes.
And I wasn't going to talk about it now, but it's funny because I made a note that when I asked Jesse, like this was years ago, I said, "Have you ever read the Culture books?" And he's like, "No, I've never read it." And I was like, "Oh, you should read it." He's like, "Oh, I listened to a." Or maybe I wasn't on the podcast, but him and Scott on the SFF audio podcast, they were saying, "Oh, the Culture book, I've not read any, but I've listened to this audio adaptation of State of the Art." And they said it sounded very much like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it does in a way, because they're like, "Oh, we're going to the Earth, and we're going to ride down in a car." You know, and they ride the Volkswagen station wagon, or what is it?
It's a Volvo.
Volvo, yeah. They ride the Volvo down from space. And there's lots of... really,
and it's a red Volvo.
Yeah, red Volvo. There's lots of really silly stuff at the beginning, which is all in the book. You know, pretty much all of it's in the book. It's like, well, how do we get from space to planet? In a Volvo. Great. And, and there's all that kind of stuff. So there is a lot of silliness in a way that you think, it is a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So why don't we just, well, we're not going to contact the Earth, but let's put a big bubble around the Earth. And the people in the Earth don't know there's a bubble, but just to protect them from, like in a greenhouse, you know, from the rest of the galaxy. And I do quite like the idea of that, because you think, and this does work out well, going back to the previous point, it's like, what is the history of the Earth? In how is the history of the Earth involved with the culture? And it's not. But this is a good way to say that, the culture is actually out there, and our Earth history is going on, but we're a control experiment, so we're never going to be contacted.
Yeah.
So Earth, we've got to survive by ourselves. We've got to do our own things. We've got to look after our own problems, because the culture is not going to come in to intervene, which is actually quite hopeful in a way. You know, it's quite... it's quite interesting. Well, it's like Ian and Banks.
I think it would be more hopeful if there were a culture coming.
No, because that's what this whole book is about. That a lot of the main conversations. I mean, the thing is that I don't like so much about this book, about this story, about the State of the Art, the novella, is the fact that in these other books, a lot of the big questions, and I've mentioned this before quite a few times on these different podcasts, like not so much for the culture series, but like if you're going to have political discussions and if you're going to have philosophical discussions, have it with space battles going on or intrigue, or have like deep story going on. And I do like the story in this, but I did feel that the story was kind of overwhelmed at some points by characters telling each other the super text. Like, there wasn't, like, subtext between the characters when they were talking to each other. It's like, well, I think humanity is this. Well, I think humanity is this. Well, I think humanity is this. Well, the culture is like this. Well, the future should be like this. Well, the challenges, you know, and war is bad. And this is good. And it felt like characters, like, preaching and teaching and talking. Do you have a note
and
here?
The climax of this was, for me, Lee's speech.
Yeah, he does this whole rant against consumerism.
Is this philosophical speech, and it was just way too long, and it was so Like, I really had to fight my way through that.
Because you were reading it, weren't you?
Yes.
Thing is, I was listening to Peter Kenny do an audio rendition of it, and it was actually really good fun. But like I say, it's so much of it on the surface. Whereas what I love about the other culture books, and we've discussed this time and time again, like with the use of weapons, it's so subtle. You do get people having conversations about, is war good? Is war... Well, it's not even that. It's just like, let's just throw this guy into the middle of a war and then move him to another war and then move him to another war. You know, you kind of follow this guy between and you follow through with the story that so it isn't just literally two people in a room having a conversation about the good and
but
bad
I
of the culture.
This is also a problem of the novella. You don't have so much, so you can't have so much action.
No, it's not that. I honestly think, I mean, I don't know if, put it this way, I think the story could have stood by itself a lot more just by the action, you know, just by the decisions that the character made. I really enjoyed the travelogue part of it where Desire was going to the different
that was really
different
good
parts
fun.
But I'm saying those kind of observations about humanity and her looking at that and seeing her, I don't think then after doing that we needed to have speeches by her and then by the ship and then by Dervley Lintner and then by Lee back on the ship, you know, back on the, you know, in this thing.
Yeah.
And I felt that again just listening to the audio drama version, the BBC audio drama, and it started off and within like 10 minutes I was kind of like, ooh, Dizzy A. Smar is getting angry at Earth and is really like, she was just laying down the plot point. She was just laying down the thematic exploration so...
But like, this is also because they cut down...
Yes, they cut out a lot. But that kind of reminded me a lot of the main issue that I have with this book. All of the speeches are interesting, I find. You know, when he's, you know, he does a speech and he's dressed up as Captain Kirk or whoever he's meant to be.
With a lightsaber.
Yeah, Captain Kirk with a lightsaber and he's wanting to be voted in as the thing. But, you know, him, Lee, as a character saying, I'm going to vote, you know, I want to be voted in as captain and you can be this. That is action enough for me to tell me the difference between Earth systems and the Earth's view of the future in Star Trek and the culture's view. You know, that culture is taking the piss out of Star Trek is good enough for me.
Yes, but this actually is my most critic-worth point. I don't know how to say that.
Yeah.
How he was acting was so much more human-like than Earth-like that was also a point when I was so confused.
What, because you thought he was an Earth man?
He acted so much more like an Earth person and
this is Lee on the ship.
Lee on the ship, because he's too hairy. He can't go down onto Earth.
But the point is that he
stays on the ship.
But the point that he does that is that the only way he's getting the Earth is by the popular culture on TV and radio and music and stuff.
Exactly.
And movies. So that's why he's watching Star Trek and Star Wars.
By trying to do this election party thing to become a captain, this is so human.
Yes.
And
that's my point, is that his character, who is trying to be as human as possible or trying to bring on these different things, is enough for me to go, so he's representing, even though his culture, he's representing the culture taking on the best or the worst or whatever of the humanity. And Lintner down there is culture taking on the other, like, side of, like, the darker side
like
of...
the reality.
Reality. Yeah. So one person's taking on the fantasy of humanity in the future. The other one is taking on the reality.
But
and
Dizier
is going between these characters. That was enough conversation of it. And then I didn't need the speeches on top. You know?
But on the other hand, Lee wants the Earth to be destroyed.
He doesn't really want the Earth to be destroyed. He's just making
he's
a
sure.
point. Yeah. He's like our friend Georg, when we were saying he did that political part thing, and he was saying,
you mean he's sarcastic?
Of course he doesn't. Of course Georg doesn't think that Dresden should be bombed again and the Berlin Wall be put up. But he's being a provocateur. He's doing I don't know, a political, you know, he's doing absurd political propaganda.
Explain that. Other people think we have weird friends.
Yeah, we have weird friends. A guy who's in a crazy...
Not really friend.
He's a friend.
A friend.
Yeah.
Not my friend.
No, he's a friend. Anyway, so Georg, he's a comedian and he does comedy political activism. And he was in a protest and he got mostly naked and painted stuff across his body. And anyway, it's quite funny.
But it's in an art critic.
Yeah,
it's kind of way.
Yes, it's like as a like I say, it's but it, but that's what I'm saying that
So you say that Lee is...
He's doing a similar thing, yeah.
Is sarcastic.
Of course it's sarcastic. He doesn't actually want to destroy the Earth. He is,
oh, really? I actually thought it.
No, he's doing a whole performance art piece about becoming the captain. And no, him becoming the captain of a ship's mind is totally absurd. And everyone knows it. And they're all just going along with it. In the same party, they're eating human flesh. They're eating chili con... What is it? Chili con Pinochet.
Pinochet con chili.
Yeah,
no, Pinochet con carne.
Pinochet chili con carne. That's the environment that he's saying that he's doing this speech. You know, it isn't real. He doesn't actually mean
it.
You know?
I thought he did.
He doesn't really want to destroy the Earth. So what do we like about this book? Because I've talked about the preachiness.
I really like when Dizzy Edsmar does her sightseeing tour, kind of.
Yeah, I made some notes about this. So she goes to London.
Yeah.
And Paris, and she goes to this memorial, and this actually makes... We visited this last year, didn't we?
And it's really funny, because you read this book before, and you said, hey, I want to go to this memorial.
Yeah.
And I had no idea where this comes from, what was this memorial and stuff. So we went to behind Notre Dame. There's this little bit of...
A little
triangular park. And there's this Holocaust memorial. And we went there before I have read this book.
Yes, but I knew that from this book. I mean, I guess I'd heard of it otherwise, or seen it otherwise, or kind of knew about it, I guess. But yeah, it was like, oh, I was going back to Paris. I'd like to check this out. Last time I was there, I knew about this because I'd read this book. And I thought I'd go and visit it, but then... we didn't get round to it. I can't remember because it had been with Pola, previous girlfriend, and I don't know. We just didn't get there for some reason. Yeah. We just went in a different direction. I think I looked at the other end of the island. Actually,
we visited that.
Yeah,
and it was actually quite impressive. I mean, I have seen quite. Oh, I might wouldn't say a lot of Holocaust memorials
in Germany. But we are Holocaust memorial experts.
You are reminded of that all the time.
Yes.
In Berlin, we also have this memorial. So by going there...
You have many memorials.
Yes, of course. But by going there in Paris, this memorial was actually very, very impressive. And the way she explains this in the book actually...
How she
is describing the feeling that you get when you go down there.
Yeah.
And how you can feel the horror of Holocaust and stuff. Was very, very convincing.
Yeah.
And
I do like these experiential memorials, which, you know, especially around like the one in Berlin, you go inside the memorial, you know.
That's... And you think, ah, oh, well, it's just some concrete blocks.
Or
there.
A cave or
but
a thing with a light in
there,
it. Yeah.
And because the ground is not flat, it goes up and down.
This is the one in Berlin we're talking about.
Yes,
there, yeah.
It goes up and down and you get lower down and the concrete gets higher and higher and you feel so tiny and you feel lost.
Yeah.
And I think...
You are lost.
You are lost. And yeah, you can get lost there. And
if you two people go in at the same time, one person goes in one and it's like, and you think, oh, well, I'll turn left and then turn right and we'll meet up again. Nope. You have to arrange a meeting point at some other, like at the other side. It's like, we'll meet up at the other side if we get lost. And people are like, get lost? What do you mean?
And then
like
10
minutes later, they come out and they're like, oh, I got all turned around. I don't know where I was going.
So you just read out the list where she was.
Oh yeah, but
so
I'm saying that we went to this place in Paris,
in
and
Paris,
I was like, hey,
exactly.
This is from this book, and you're like, what book? And I'm like, hey, we'll see it.
We will read it, and now I read it, and now I know.
Now you understand.
Yes.
Because I was saying, this is the memorial, which is a cunt, and you're like, what? And I'm like, when you read the book, you'll understand.
Yes.
And it was funny listening to the BBC adaptation. They were like, well, most memorials are phallic, and this one is like, and I was like, in the book they say it's a cunt.
Yeah.
It
is understandable. I would just describe the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. It has concrete
pillars. Yeah.
Which is phallic.
No, it's not. It's not phallic. That's more like if we're going for that, it's more like an array of pubic hair, you know. But I'm just saying that I don't think the thing that makes the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe, as it's called in English in Berlin, unique is that it isn't a protuberance, and it isn't anything like that.
It consists of several phallic symbols.
No, but the way that when you're standing next to one, yes, maybe, but
exactly,
it's not like the like the TV tower.
It is not like outstandingly phallic, but it consists of it. So
I would disagree.
The other one is really like you go into you go into a hole.
Yes, you do. You you.
Anyway,
you
penetrate the depths. I would consider everybody who visits Paris and
should check it out.
Yeah, go and check it out
and read this book, because you'll then see it in a different light. So they go on to she also goes to India, which I was actually listening to this as an audiobook while walking around Mumbai, and said, oh, there's the squalor and then this, and I was like, yep, I'm
right
walking around walking around, and look over there is a slum and stuff like that. And then she goes to Berlin, and there's some fun
in
stuff
the,
in Berlin
in the 70s, right?
Yeah, in the 70s
Cold War's going on. And the city, she describes it like as being like horrible.
Well, yeah, but one thing I did like was that how she was describing, over here you can see the history of gunfights as you go down the street.
Yes.
And there's less now, but even...
But you
even
still
like,
can.
Yeah, well, I moved to Berlin like 8 years ago, and even since 8 years, they've covered up a lot more bullet holes. Like, they've done a lot of patching up work.
Right.
And they say, oh, you can see there was somebody here, and then they were being shot at from that window over there, and you can see... And yeah, like, if you go down to Museum Island and look around those,
still...
they're like, they say that's where they're patching up a lot now, but there's still loads of bullet holes. There's lots of that kind of stuff going on.
And even if you don't see the bullet holes anymore, you see where the the patches are.
Where were we? Was it in Berlin? I said, hey, look here on the ground. You could see where a mortar or a grenade had hit. And it would kind of made these dimples across thing. But then they'd obviously lifted up a stone, one of those paving stones for some reason. And when they put it down 90 degrees off. Where was that? Was that in Berlin?
I think it was.
But I quite liked battle archaeology, as in like seeing where people were shooting from and to.
Yeah. But also she was talking about the East and West separation.
Yeah.
And about the...
And you're an East German.
I'm an East German, but I was 5 years old when the wall came down.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really count that much. But she was also talking about the Secret Service thing, and being watched and listened.
Yeah, but I think that's quite interesting that she was looking at home being watched. But she is most comfortable when the ship is looking after her and watching it all the time.
Yeah.
So there was some fun, like, oh, wouldn't it be great to live in a 100% surveillance society? And then she visits East Berlin and is like, yes, well, no, well,
no.
You know, depends who's in charge.
But she also describes Berlin as being quite a unique city.
It is a unique city.
Yeah.
Or it was a unique city.
Yeah, and I think she...
Well, let's see how it goes in Kiev.
What?
In the Ukraine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, that's all new Cold War going on there.
I
don't need to talk about politics and stuff there anyway.
But I think it was really fun to have somebody from an outside world visiting the cities that I know.
Yeah.
And
also,
I live in...
Oslo, she goes to Oslo and they go to a sculpture park where I've also visited.
I haven't visited Oslo yet.
Nope, Oslo, but one of the reasons why I visited that sculpture park in Oslo is also because I've been there so many times I run out of things to do, but I was like, oh yeah, that was also in State of the Art, so it's quite an interesting place. She goes to Thera in Santorini. That was the place that she thought was going to be the last place she visited, where she went to go and see the sunset. And we visited there.
Yeah, we visited.
Last year, or 2
very
years ago.
Very nice place.
Yep, so you can go to a big volcano and see the sunset over stupidly high cliffs. And
very
the
white buildings.
Yeah, all these white buildings edge of an old volcano. And then she ends up in New York in winter, which is...
probably not that... fun.
Not that fun, but I think that was the whole point, is that she goes there and then that's what happens at the end of the story. You said before, the worst part of the book was where Dervley Lintner says, I found Jesus, and you were like, oh, why, what's that?
Also,
you think that was a step too far?
Yes.
I think it was a step too far as well.
Because, like, really? And then he says, oh yeah, and God is inside the ship too.
Yeah, God is everywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, just by saying these words, it's kind of makes me feel like, no, that can't be. It's unlogical.
Well, I just read this book by Clifford D. Simak and reviewed it last time out, called Way Station, and that's from the 1960s or 50, yeah, early 60s. And one of the things that it kind of stood out to me to tell how old it was is that there was this kind of spiritual bit to it. There's this object which is like the spiritual heart of the galaxy or something like that. And it's gone and everyone can tap it. And some people can tap into this spiritual heart of the galaxy and do telepathy and things like that. And it suddenly felt like a throwback to this, almost to the science fiction of the 1970s, where this character was like, and now I found Jesus. And I was like, oh, that feels such... Like, now that kind of approach feels kind of dated, you know, to bring in that... spiritual dimension or that religious dimension, which and like the culture feels like should have like stranger in a strange land. Yeah, because something goes, oh, and now we're going to do a religion bit, and I'm like, aren't we past talking about religion in such blatant terms? I don't know. I think there's still a lot of stuff to talk about religion.
On the other hand, he's not only talking about God.
Who,
he's also
Dervley, Limiter,
He's also talking about sin and how the culture kind of forgot about the sin or this bit reminds me a tiny bit of Play of Games where people are so bored that they actually play war games to have something exciting happening.
Yeah.
Because there is no sin in the culture.
Yeah, they have to create their own conflict.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tiny bit what he is missing something in the culture. And this is why he goes to Earth.
Yeah.
Because he can find a lot of things on Earth that is not in the culture anymore. Or not at all.
Yeah.
And, I think that's a tiny part of that, too, that he's talking about sin. And
yeah, I just thought, I just didn't think that was needed. Like, if we had have joined it with Scientology, no, maybe not, no, that's taking a different direction. But, I'm saying, I don't want him to found a cult, but, it just suddenly goes, and suddenly Christianity, and I felt that would have been a bit an easy way out. Like, if it had been a different religion, or a bit more of an obscure religion, which kind of can account for, like Buddhism,
comes closer to his mindset, maybe.
Yeah, but which isn't a supernatural. Well, Buddhism is, but there isn't a single god. You know, there isn't a single god in Buddhism. Maybe, I'm not sure, but I think there could have been a better fit than just suddenly and then Jesus Christ, and I'm probably have done.
Maybe there's
like
a point
what has Christianity got to offer anybody who has lived in the culture for the contact unit? I can understand what Earth has to offer, but it kind of felt like he'd convinced himself that he needed it. He needed to identify with Earth. Reminds me of the movie Contact, where they're like, "Oh, and you're a scientist. Well, why should you go to? Why should you go across to the star?" This is talking to Jodie Foster. It's "Well, you're an atheist, and 99% of the people on Earth are not atheists, or whatever it is." You're not representative for the majority of Earth because you are an atheist. And then they get someone else to do it, and in the end, she does go. But it's one of those things. It's does Dervley Lintner, has he convinced himself that he needs to experience spirituality from a religious point of view? Does he need that? Does he need that kind of bigger than himself from in humanity on Earth's conception rather than something bigger than himself, actually the ship mind?
Yes.
he's taken a substitute for the culture itself, and the substitute for the culture, which is that overarching kind of philosophical and rule set.
Yeah,
he's taken God or Christianity as that culture substitute.
Maybe also to understand human behavior a bit better.
Maybe
war and other bits.
He needs to see it from the religious point of view.
Yes,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about this point with the religion suddenly turning up, and when it was very weird when they met in New York, and then he said, "Hey, I must tell you something," and then you have different things in mind.
What could it be? Yeah,
yeah, and in the end it says, and then he says, "I found God."
Found Jesus, yeah.
And then I think, well, okay. And I think this was also what Dizzy at Smar was thinking at this point, because she didn't say anything about
it. No, she has nothing to add. It's like a conversation stopper, isn't it?
You found a God.
Yeah, but there are things that people say in conversation where you just go, I realise now we're going to be coming from such different points of view that there's literally nothing I can say to you.
Yeah.
Like, it's when someone is saying, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but when somebody goes, blah, 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 and then acupuncture, and I'm how can I talk to someone about, acupuncture if they believe that acupuncture is real, or homeopathy, one of those things where it's
No. This is something totally different. There's something different if you believe that something works.
Yes.
And then it works.
Yeah.
My point is from the point that it's not scientific.
No, my point is that at that point, of the conversation. There's nothing I can say which is going to move the conversation onwards or backwards or sideways. You know, it's literally just like, well, I guess I've got to stop talking to this person until they change the topic. You know.
Yeah.
Whereas if someone talks about Christianity, I used to be a Christian, so for me there's a way in there. Do you understand like that?
Okay.
So my point is that Didier Smart at that point when he goes, "I found Jesus," she's just like, right. Like, I need to just leave it up for you to talk this out. And once I have a connection to you again, like, once I find a connection, then we can continue the conversation. Yeah.
But while
you're talking about acupuncture...
But he misunderstands that.
Yeah, he misunderstands that
side. She's okay with that. She's like, oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Good that you found it.
So let's not spend too long on this because we've got another two stories to finish off with. I did make two more notes about this one. One is that the radio version that we listened to, which I actually quite enjoyed, I would say don't listen to that first. I'd say read the book first.
Yes, definitely.
But because it does change it in some ways. For example, I put here that Didier Smart and Dervli Linter, they've got like a history together. They are obviously some kind of ex-lovers, or maybe when she was a man and he was a woman. I'm not quite sure what they were talking about. It's like, oh, I'm not going to be a woman. I can't be, you know, at the end of the story, it's like, I can't change my sex again. Yeah. Sorry about that. And I'm like, oh, so he was probably a woman when they had a love affair in the past.
Yeah, maybe.
And because Dizier is saying to the ship, well, my last three lovers have been female and you want me to get together with a male again.
Yeah.
You homophobe. He's like, oh.
Yeah.
So I understand why they've done that within the, you know, because it does give them a personal connection, which I feel like they didn't really have in the book. It's sort of like, well, he'll talk to you. Why? Well, it's just, she just happened to be the one that he sent to her. You know, it wasn't for any personal reasons. It was more for...
I mean, mate, they seem to be friends.
Yes, they were friends. And then they have sex. In the book, they have sex. And then they have that, like, what they say, we said goodbye to each other with the right level of uncomfortableness in the morning to make sure that the sex wasn't too important. We could leave just as friends and carry on again as though we didn't have sex. Or, you know, it'll just be part of their relationship that they have sex. You know, and that kind of thing I thought was interesting, the different approach that they had. And I actually think it did make it for an easier radio version that they could just, because it was kind of hinted at, you know, at the beginning, it was never that explicit, and it became more explicit. And I actually liked that, rather than the book where she's like saying, "Stop trying to get us together. We're not gonna get together. We're not gonna have sex." And then they have sex, and you're like, "Okay, well, that's obviously something they're not gonna put
in." But also, there was the sex discussion.
What?
With Lee.
Yeah. Oh well, he's all having sex all the time. Oh, he wants.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Which again was hinted at in the radio play version.
Yes.
So the other thing that I mentioned, the other note was that they say the culture is infecting the galaxy with sterility, and I made a note of that because I think that's a really interesting line. And this is why I'm saying that for me, the culture isn't utopian, because it's utopia. If it stopped expanding or stopped doing anything, for the people in it, it would still be utopian, and for the people outside of it, it wouldn't be utopian.
Yeah.
But the vision of the vision of the culture, which is that they want to get the galaxy to the point where everybody is living in a culture-like thing. You know, that's their mission.
Yeah.
Or that's the logical endpoint for the culture, is that everyone is living a life of luxury without any wars and stuff, which is a very noble goal. But to get there, they pretty much wipe out all of these developing civilizations.
Yeah.
You know, the other civilizations are on natural courses to go somewhere good or bad, maybe somewhere better than the culture, maybe not somewhere as good. But the culture is very... very secure in their vision, even though they're not, you know, they do have doubts, but they all seem to be very secure in their vision that the culture is the best way.
They always have doubts.
They always
it's
have
like
doubts,
they always have doubts. Are we doing the right thing?
But then they always do it
something
anyway.
Alone or intervening.
But they're doing this with the whole galaxy.
Yeah.
And that's why I like about these other books as well, like the, like Use of Weapons. He's like, well, are the culture the good guys? I hope so. I like to think so, but I'm not sure.
Never
they never know. And they'll do it anyway. But I know this infecting the galaxy with sterility is the main issue that Linter has. Linter has, and all these other people have. You know, like the war, the Edirans in the war, and Bora Horzer and Morzegal, or whatever his name is, the shapeshifter, and these other characters, all of these characters who are often main characters or main aspects in the book, they're looking at the culture and going, I'm not so sure this is the best way to do this. You know, are we really doing the right thing? And this is an important line because it was in the audio drama. And there was a line in when we read Solaris. We read it as a book, did an audio version, the two movies, and the audio drama, the BBC audio drama of that.
Yeah.
And they all had one line, and we kept hearing this line over and over. You know, in the English version, the Russian version, and they kept this line always stood out. I can't remember exactly what it was, what the line was, but it was a similar line.
Yeah.
But we could tell it was the line that always stood out to people because it was included in all the adaptations as the central line that starts off the conflict or starts off the idea of the book.
Yeah.
So talking of this, I actually I had an ebook version of this, and I also listened to it because it came out as an Audible version on Audible, narrated by Peter Kenny, who does all of these other books, Ian M. Banks books, the culture books. So if you want this book for free, I do recommend it. It's a good variety. I would suggest starting with Player of Games if you're starting off with the culture, but check this out. Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and you can get this book for free and help support the SFBRP. The money comes into my bank account. Well, you know, it just does stuff. This is a great... I'm being totally distracted by Juliana. What are you looking for now?
Sorry, just...
You're looking through the Solaris notes now, aren't you? Well, you carry on with that. So, yes, help support the SFBRP. Get a free audiobook. Just sign up for a plan or just check out one of the free audiobooks that you can get. There's 200,000 audiobooks there on Audible now and some really fantastic science fiction, especially read by Peter Kenny, who did this one. So that's audibletrial.com/SFBRP. Stop looking at your notes now. We can look that up later. So you didn't listen to the audio version, did you?
No, I read the German book from... let me check. Where is that book?
I don't know. I thought you would have it right here.
Yeah,
it's not upstairs. Well, Juliana's getting the book. I just want to say one thing. There are footnotes in this, and the footnotes... that's what I wanted to say, actually. At the end of the book, we get this really great thing. It's sort of like a letter from the editor, which is actually the drone, which is Skaffan Amtiskor, or whatever his
name is. My favourite drone.
And he comes in, and at the very end of the book, he goes, "Well, thank goodness that's over. I don't mind telling you, this has been an extremely difficult translation, you know," and it's because it's Amtiskor who has been then translating this into English for us.
Yeah.
And as you go through, there are footnotes, and of course the footnotes come up at the actually right at the very end of the ebook. Look, I think you can because they come up is it right at the end? Anyway, it's difficult to track them all down, but what works out really well, look, you see, these are those are those things that come up. But the great thing is in the audiobook is that the footnotes are done in line. But it drops out from Dizier Smar's voice and then comes into the, you know, Peter Kenny puts on the drone's voice and goes, well, this is just a less precise restatement of Sturgeon's law. You know, blah, blah, blah. This is effectively untranslatable, you know.
Yeah.
And he actually brings in his own... he goes, "Smar refuses to choose between British English and American English. This would be randiest in British English," because she says, "I'm horny." And, you're always the horniest one. It's like, well, in British English, this would be randy.
Oh, really?
But, okay. Yeah, and that's what I really liked about the audio book is that...
Yeah, you have that in the German book, obviously.
Yes, but like I say,
too.
Because it's an e-book, it's very difficult to do footnote formatting.
Yeah.
So it's just a hyperlink to the back and back to the front again. I'm just saying in the audio book, I really liked the drone interrupting the flow of the story.
Yeah. What I recognised in the German book was that the formatting of this book is a bit different because you have all these, you have this text, and then you have some of it standing out to the left a bit.
Yeah,
and
it's like it's like an inverse indent, because normally the paragraph is indented inwards, and this time the start of the paragraphs are indented outwards,
yes.
But only when people are talking, is it? Or?
No,
no.
I didn't find.
Is that through the whole book?
Yes, it's only in that story.
Okay, well that's very strange.
It's only in that story.
Why is it like that?
I don't know. And okay. I thought actually that would be a thing in the English book. It's not, obviously.
Well, it's not in the ebook. I can't remember it being that way in the paper book that
anyway,
I read ages
so
ago.
I got this book from the library in German, and
what do you think of the translation? Because you've read some Ian M. Banks in English and some in German.
Yeah, the English was the German was okay.
Yeah,
was good, and yeah, this is from 1992, the German book. So it's definitely not one of those that are by just secretly shortened or...
Yeah, it's a full book. It's not abridged.
It's not an abridged version.
Well, that's good. So, but it's got a different name. Let's go into this because this will tie us nicely into what the next book is. It's not called State of the Art in German. It's called...
The gift from the culture.
Yeah. No, but in German. Just read it in German, yeah.
Ein Geschenk der Kultur.
Yeah, A Gift from the Culture, which is another culture story in this short story collection. So let's talk about that one for the next 5 minutes, and then the other one for the next 5 minutes.
How is the order in the English one? Is it the same?
Yeah, it's the same order. The order is The Road of Skulls, Gift from the Culture, Odd Attachment, Descendant, Cleaning Up, Peace, State of the Art, and Scratch. So stop fiddling about this book. It's really loud, and you're talking into the book. You've got to talk into the microphone instead of holding the book in front of your face all the time. So don't stick your tongue out with me. People in the audio on the podcast can't hear.
They shouldn't see it.
Well, they can't see it. Okay, but it doesn't. Your comeback, your witty comeback, doesn't really come across onto the podcast if it's just. Mm. Oh, okay, that works too. So, what are your any notes on the gift from the culture? This is one of those fantastic things where the guy, once again, it's such a story, there's not much to say about it, but what I really like is that he's getting a gift from the culture, and he's ex-culture, but then he doesn't know if the culture wants him to do that. You know, it's one of those things like in Use of Weapons, where he isn't sure if he's meant to shoot. Like, he's going on the paranoid thing because he knows how the culture work and that he could be an unknowing plant.
Yeah.
Like, because he's someone who has gone native, and he's like, but maybe the culture wanted me to go native, or maybe they put me here because they knew that my mindset would be that I would be the one who would go native.
Because the culture is using the inhabitants.
Yes, all the time. And I really quite like this as a statement. Talking about, like, this for me works so much more thematically when it's not one person saying, and I think this, and humanity is this, and blah, blah. It's this one guy who is having a crisis of faith and a crisis of, like, fate. You know, he doesn't know if it's fated for him to do this, and in his view the culture is as powerful as God. Like, all of the questions that we all have about God, about, you know, like, is this God's plan for me, did God mean this, is it fated that I was going to do this, all those kind of things, he's having those same crisis about, did the culture want me to do this, am I here, is everything all that, this kind of stuff. And it's a fun story about him getting a cool gun as well. Do you have anything else to say about The Gift from the Culture?
No, not really. I haven't done any of the others. Of the other short stories, I didn't really make any notes.
This is why
the short story called Peace and The Road of Skulls were quite disturbing to me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, The Descendant is nice. I really enjoyed
that. Well, let's talk about The Descendant then, because that's my other favourite in here. It's like the second longest story, isn't it? And it's also the culture one, because it's about a guy in a suit. The culture is never explicitly mentioned, but ships' minds are mentioned. His biology is mentioned. It's kind of like, he's culture, but he's not culture normal. He's like a culture ambassador, so he doesn't have all of the normal... all of the normal plumbing that's built into culture people.
Yes.
He's had some of that restricted. So it's a guy who crash lands on a planet and has to walk a few thousand kilometres.
Isn't it Mars? Doesn't it say Mars?
No, it doesn't say Mars.
It feels like Mars.
The thing
Mars
is, we read The Martians, or we listened to the audiobook of The Martian.
Yes.
By, what was his name? I can't remember the guy who wrote The Martian now.
Andy Weir,
yeah. So that's all about a guy who is stranded on Mars, and he has to get, at one point, he has to plan a journey and get here, and it's all about, we've got to get from there, and we've got to save breath, and got to save water, and got to save energy. Yeah. And all of that technology that he spends months going through, and there's like massive mission to Mars, and he's got rovers and nuclear power plants and radios and hydrogen, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The culture is so far advanced that all of that whole novel is all of the technology in the novel of The Martian is wrapped up into
is the suit. Yeah.
And the suit's trying to communicate with him. Oh, no, he's trying to use the suit to communicate, and they're not quite sure where.
Yeah.
If they're going to get somewhere, and he has to get to the place.
A cool ending, though.
Yeah, but there's a disturbing ending as well. Like, it's,
yeah.
But it's one of those things that the suit is going on, and the suit has a mind, because that's another reason why you can see it, that they say, oh, I picked out a suit which is intelligent enough to look after me in case anything goes wrong.
But not too intelligent.
Yeah, but not too intelligent, so he doesn't want to have like a drone level intelligence or someone that's super intelligent. But
like,
to
so
be...
he doesn't have like a drone like Scar, Antisquare.
Yeah, so he doesn't.
It's like a bit annoying.
But the point is to have something that is as intelligent enough to be able to make all the decisions to look after you properly has to have a consciousness which is, you know, similar to humanity.
Yes.
You know, humans. To be able to understand a human's wishes, you have to have a human level consciousness. But by the rights of the culture, you can't have a human level consciousness which doesn't have, you know, a certain amount of free will and a certain amount of personality.
Obviously, yes.
So it's quite interesting, this guy who's walking across. What I did like about that is that there's these different things. He starts singing and he drives the suit crazy and he has to do it. And then it's like, he says, and then I masturbated all this time. And he says, but don't worry, it's all recycled. And I'm like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
And of all the things, you just go, yeah, of course, The Martian.
Great.
With Andy Weir. Mm. And, you know, I'm sure that guy was masturbating and was going, well, it's all recycled.
Why guys always, can't guys just live without
masturbating? I'm just saying that was
something you need, you guys need to live?
Yes, pretty much.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't, did you not know this?
No.
If you don't masturbate, you just go crazy.
Holy shit.
Really?
There's something really wrong with guys.
No, it's not. It's biology. But that's.
I think this is why women are better than men.
Yeah.
You see, women can just live without having to...
We keep producing sperm. It's got to go somewhere.
Okay.
Biologically, I'm not sure if that's entirely accurate. But psychologically, physiologically, maybe not. Psychologically, definitely, yes. We have to get rid of the sperm. So what else did I write about? Oh, yeah. So... yeah, I think that's it. Otherwise, a fun collection of stories. There's the last story doesn't work very well as a written piece.
Especially
not translated into German.
Yeah, the last one.
Scratch.
I don't know.
But when it's performed by Peter Kenny,
It looks just like a creative writing
exercise.
From the 1930s, from the Dada.
No. It's very 90s. It's very.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but it's all about, you know, lots of stuff about. You see this won't make, but it's very, lots of references to popular culture of the time of in Britain. In the late 80s, 90s, or something. Yeah, so
there's another story I really actually quite enjoyed, which was...
Wait a second, I thought we were just wrapping up now. Okay, carry on, let's do it.
Oh, sorry, no, I just wanted to say that I quite enjoyed cleaning up as well.
What was that?
It was the one where the ship, by one of the rubbish dumps, by accident...
Oh, yeah, it was actually a recycling plant.
It threw down on Earth some rubbish.
Oh, yeah, waste disposal, yeah.
Some alien rubbish, which reminded me then of the roadside picnic, which I just read, and which was quite funny.
Did you finish it?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, we haven't talked about that, because I was away on the trip. You didn't say what you liked about it. You enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. It was quite, for me, it was quite Russian and quite philosophical, but I really enjoyed this whole idea of... like
discarded technology being way more than we can understand.
Yeah, and then we do appreciate that, and it could be just I don't know, if we go on a picnic and we leave something somewhere,
the pixies and gnomes come out and find
it? Or whatever, it's like ants, and they find something and they're like, yay, there's something really cool,
and then it blows up and sucks them apart and things.
So but I really enjoyed that one too, because then they had to get the rubbish bag back that they threw it down on.
But what I like about that compared to Roadside Picnic is that these are defective bits of technology that sometimes work and sometimes don't work.
Yeah.
Whereas in there's a difference between discarded technology and defective technology. This is defective stuff, so everything was brand new, but they didn't want to use it, so they were just getting rid of it and trying to drop it into the star. but it wasn't the star. They dropped it on Earth by accident.
Yeah.
But then in Roadside Picnic, it's technology that it's so far beyond understanding that they don't know if it's defective. They don't know if it's important or not important, if yes. it's rubbish or not rubbish, or if it's a battery, if it's a computer, or, you know, all these things, yes. or if it's just so far outside of the realms of experience of yeah. the humanity.
Also, I quite
at the same
like
time.
That that these little gifts kind of. Like, I was wondering, why wasn't that called the gift from the culture?
Because it's not a culture novel.
I know, but it was really funny because then it came down on Earth in several places and then people found it.
Well, it was randomly scattered across the world,
exactly.
wasn't it?
So I really enjoyed that one too because it also was another story related alien world. If it's not the culture, it was some kind of other alien with Earth. So that I really enjoyed.
Yeah. So let me have a... Oh, I went on the wrong thing here. Let me see if I can find some other notes. No more notes there. Oh. Title page. Do I hear? So what else do we have to say about it? Some pretty cool illustrations. That I got. Those illustrations?
No illustrations in my book.
Don't worry about it. So,
but you didn't get that in your audiobook either.
No, well, that's why I had the ebook and the audiobook here. So that's pretty cool. So I think that's everything we want to say. We've been talking, almost exactly an hour. So let's say if you want to discuss this with us, you can just check out our individual reviews. Oh, we're going to give it a star rating just for the main story, just for the state of the art. I would say 3.5 stars. What would you say?
Yes, me too.
3.5 stars. I do think it could. It could have been improved with less preaching or, like, slightly... I don't know, it's just a totally different tone from the rest of the culture books. Everything else in the culture books is done by, not so much action, but just by, like, what's in the story gives across the thematic exploration, you know, certainly with Player of Games and what's the other one? Yeah.
Use of Weapons?
Use of Weapons, mm-hmm. Player of Games, and I was just looking... Let me have a look here. And the other one.
How do the other guys find it here?
And consider Phlebas as well. Again, that's all action, you know, and that's that kind of stuff.
How do the other people on Goodreads rate the state
on
of
Goodreads?
Year?
Well, let's have a look. In general, it's got a 3.82 rating. But of course, this is for the whole collection.
Yeah, but this is actually what I would give it. I mean, I gave it 4 stars, but I think 3.82
It's like a high 3.5 stars,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
But I can't rate it 4 stars alongside other 4 star books by Ian and Banks. You know, it's definitely below his other work in the culture.
It is. And it is different, so you can't really compare
And friends of mine, out of 78 people who have rated it, although some of them might have just rated it as 2 read. Yeah, but look at that. Quite a lot of... Lots of 3 and 4 stars, and in the end it gets 3.7.
Yeah,
no, 3.42 on average from SFBRP listeners or friends of mine on goodreads.com. So the best way to get in contact with us and talk about this is actually to go along and join up with the Goodreads SFBRP listener group and click on the Culture Series book discussion or just go onto one of our reviews and chat to us then. You can email me luke@juggler.net and I do reply to every email I get. If you've got a book that you want me to review, don't send it to me. Don't even bother emailing me. It's getting up to about 4 per day now of people wanting to send me books to review. I don't know. It must be a rush. Maybe lots of people have finished their NaNoWriMo November novels or something like that. And they're all like, oh, now my novella is out. Let me send it to you. And I'm like, no. And if you're going to send me an email, don't send it with like 5 megabytes worth of attachments. Because when I'm on a cruise ship and I'm spending 75 cents per minute to download emails... Your email might take 10 minutes to download over slow satellite internet. Just don't do it. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge. You can check out my blog and see what we're up to. What are we up to this weekend? We're going to a tropical island.
Yay!
Inside. There's this thing near Berlin, which was built as an airship, like a Zeppelin factory and testing space.
And failed.
And it didn't work out. So they converted the inside. It's the single largest unsupported closed volume of ground or air, whatever it is. It's like the biggest, second biggest building in the world or something like that. And
but not in height, but like in...
No, what is
in it? In volume.
Let me just do it. Tropical Island, Berlin. Just imagine going along to... No, that's it. So it's like if you've seen the Truman Show. With Jim Carrey. So just imagine a big dome like the Truman Show. The tropical islands near Berlin is the closest in the world that you can get to that. It's a fake tropical island resort inside.
Very warm, obviously.
Yeah.
I wasn't there yet, but That would be fun.
Yeah, so what is it? I was going to say, yeah, it's air temperature 26 degrees Celsius and humidity 64% around the clock. So yeah, so it's a pretty impressive building. And yeah,
we will report how it was.
5.5 million cubic meters. Largest building on the earth by the footprint, largest floor space. No, it's not in largest floor space, it's by volume. Anyway, I can't see it on here, but anyway, by volume, it's one of the largest buildings in the world.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
It is.
Pretty impressive. So we're going there for the weekend. It's the Tropical Island Adventure. It's like a juggling festival, which in wherein 50 jugglers turn up and hang out for the weekend. Invade. So that'd be good. Oh, yeah, it's the largest uninterrupted volume in the world.
Okay, cool.
It's like being in Trimacher. I don't know why I'm mentioning that, but that's what we're going to do this weekend. And when we come back, we will review some other books. Maybe Flowers for Algernon, which you're reading at the moment.
Yeah,
and
really good.
I could read again.
Reading very quickly. This goes really well.
So I might give that a go. And what else? What was the other books that we're going to do?
Inversions
we'll get to next. And maybe... Oh, there was another book I was just looking at. Anyway... There's some other books that I've read and not reviewed. Have Spaceship Will Travel. I'm going to do that as an SFF audio podcast in a few weeks' time. Or I'll just do it as an SFBRP episode later on. Otherwise, let's wrap it up there.
Okay.
Say goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.